Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Anapanasati mahapalohoti mahanisangso ti. So that little chant gives away the title of this talk. One monk and another monk encouraged me to talk about actually the meditation on the breath this evening. It's nice to get that input from you, because I assume I've talked about that so often. It's in books, it's in tapes, recordings. But nevertheless, it probably is a good idea at this stage of the retreat for actually to do this big overview of the meditation on the breath, particularly how you get in contact with the breath, how you maintain awareness and the right time and what to do to let that awareness of the breath go, to proceed deep into meditation. There's a lot of myths about the mindfulness of the breath meditation. I've been meditating on the breath. That's my main object, for over 40 years now. So I pretty much know how my breath works and know what is the way to get your awareness on the breath in a way which you can maintain it for long periods of time, and also to know the right time just to let it disappear so you can go deeper into meditation. So this evening's talk is going to be all about the breath. And first of all, I have to point out that the breath in 25 centuries ago, its very word, pana, anapanasati, was the very same word which it was used in Pali, in Sanskrit, for beings. The very idea of breath had this connotation of being so close to the essence of your being, the essence of your life. So breath was the same word as living being. And having studied Latin also, it was also the same connection was in that language. The word for breath in Latin is animalis, which you all know has the connection with animal, the living beings. So animal, animalis is breath, prana, living being, prana, breath in Pali. So you imagine that a person who is watching their breath in the time of the Buddha, it had a different meaning than would have today. You were watching something which was far more, had far more meaning for you. It was like this almost essential part of your very being. So you can imagine the meditation on the breath 2500 years ago would be something far less boring, less interesting, would be something quite vital for a person. And it also would be even harder to let that breath disappear, because letting the breath disappear when you identify that with your very being, or at least most people would just know the word was the same, to let that breath go would be a very, very difficult thing to do for many people in the time of the Buddha. But of course we don't have that disadvantage now, because we know the breath is only just one part of our being. We don't really associate it so much with the essence of our existence. So it should be easier to let it go. However, it's difficult for us to do that, because we do associate the breath with our life, in the sense that people who stop breathing are supposed to be dead. It's one of the first signs which you look to see if a person is alive or dead, whether their chest is still rising or falling, whether there's air coming through their nostrils. But it is still very difficult to let that go. But it's even harder to get hold of the breath in the proper way to begin with. And of course, for many years, I, like many of you, thought that this meditation was all about getting onto the breath, staying with the breath, at all costs, no matter what it takes, and then you'll be getting somewhere in your meditation. And of course, personally, you found out that never worked. You could use your willpower, you could decide to watch the breath, and those of you who have trained your willpower, you'll be able to watch your breath for a long period of time, just as an act of will. But all that really does, it makes you very tired, very tense and stressed. And that tension comes out with the way you relate to other people, and later on you get angrier with them because you're a control freak. You can tell who control freaks are. just the way they relate to others. They tend to get angry at others because the same attitude they have to say their breath is the same attitude they have to other people. So you can tell what happens there. It's not going to be generating wholesome states of mind, certainly not wholesome states of speech and actions. There's something wrong with that. And of course I saw that in the early years as a monk. You knew there was something wrong somewhere, this controlling the breath. It just never really gave rise to wholesome qualities later on. And also it just made you tense. And of course there were those times when instead of trying to find the breath and holding the breath, that you went another way, and that was actually doing the preparations, first of all, preparing the mind before you even started looking for the breath. And that was such an important insight to know that you can't just sit down and decide, I am now going to watch the breath. You've got to prepare, first of all. In the same way that I learned through building, if you're going to lay concrete, you've got to spend a lot of time preparing the trench, first of all, to make sure the trench is just right. And you've got the reinforcing steel in it. Preparation takes much more time than actually pouring the concrete. Or even a better example, painting. For those people who have been painting a wall or who have actually painted this beautiful Java furniture which Venerable Sangharatana and Venerable Santuti make, you know, it's the sanding first of all, it's the preparation, you're putting all of the putty in the holes or whatever else, though it's a nice smooth surface, and sanding it. The preparation is 99% of getting a good job. Applying the paint is just the easy part. And that's the same with watching the breath. It's a preparation, a preparation, a preparation is vital. And of course, what is that preparation? First of all, having a comfortable body. That's that old, I was talking this evening about the Buddha realizing the only way he can get into deep meditation was to look after his body, to bring a sense of comfort and ease to his body, which is why he abandoned the ascetic practices. And abandoning the ascetic practices, his five friends abandoned him, thinking he was giving up the training, giving up the path. You're not being a tough guy anymore, you're just indulging. But of course, the Buddha realized that that was the path, the middle way, which gives this body a sense of ease, a sense of peace and comfort, so it can just sit down comfortably and not disturb you as you settle down into some basic mindfulness. If your body is tense and tight, it's got pains and aches, it's very difficult to watch the breath for too long, just the body keeps interfering. It's the same if you're meditating for long periods of time. There comes a time in your meditation, if you don't get into some samadhi quickly, where the body keeps disturbing you, and you just have to end the meditation. And if you get into a state of stillness, you're beyond the body, so the body just can't reach you anymore. That's the best way to sit for long periods of time, but that's another matter totally. To begin with, you have to get a degree of comfort to the body. And once the body is in a degree of comfort, whichever posture you wish to sit in, whatever is comfortable for you, then, as it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, and there's a very wonderful little phrase which so often that people just forget about. The first thing you do is to establish mindfulness as a priority. I always use the word as a priority, not in front of you. The same word that prior means physically in front, but also metaphorically, you know, in front of your list of important things to do. And that's its meaning, as I understand it from the Pali, Jesse, to make this mindfulness a priority before the breath. And what does that actually mean? A couple of weeks ago, I gave a teaching on mindfulness, you know, here on a Wednesday evening. What actually mindfulness is, you can tell it by this awakening of the mental faculty just to know what's happening, to be able to see it, not just see it, but see it deeply, see it clearly. And I gave the simile of in a dark room and then, in a lit room, then walking out into the darkness. You can't see at first, but if you just leave your eyes open in the darkness, the pupils dilate, you can start to see more. That's almost like an awakening of mindfulness. At first, when you start meditating, you can't experience very much. And you are actually going from the lit room with your eyes open into the dark room when your eyes are closed. It takes a while for your awareness to start building up to more subtle experiences of physical feelings in the body, and obviously sounds as well. So you have to give yourself some time for mindfulness to strengthen at the very beginning of a meditation. And what I love to do at the very beginning is to be mindful of my bodily feelings in the very beginning. Because your bodily feelings, they anchor you in the present moment. They anchor you in reality. The bodily feelings, they don't last that long. They're always pretty much changing. So they keep you interested. So you don't go thinking and fantasizing and dreaming and remembering and planning. They actually ground you, physical feelings. So they're great to start off with as a means of establishing your mindfulness. In particular, that mindfulness when I wanted to find out exactly what it meant by mindfulness. And I do thank my predecessor, Ajahn Jaco, for helping me here because, I used to do this automatically. But then, when I started teaching, he said to me once, Ajahn Brahm, you're very good about teaching the higher stages of meditation, but, you should focus more on just how to get to those stages, so to help other people. And that was really great to for me to actually to linger on what do I really mean by mindfulness and how did I establish that mindfulness strong enough so I could watch the breath. And that establishing of mindfulness was very much this present moment awareness and some silence, just focusing on those two things as my main priority. So you start there, you're sitting down, you got yourself comfortable, and now, present moment awareness, being here right in this moment, and everything which happened before, and I do a lot of things, being a boss of a monastery. So there's much which has happened to me so far today, which I have to just let go of. And of course, there's many things which I have to do tomorrow, or even this evening. So, because of my workload, which is more than any of you, it's imperative of me. I've had to do this. It's one of the advantages of taking responsibility in a monastery. One of the advantages is you have to learn how to be in the present moment. Basically, you've got no choice. It's either just be in the present moment or go crazy, because there's too many things to worry about. So you learn how just to totally let go of the past and totally let go of the future. And you do find it's not being irresponsible. The monastery doesn't go to bits if you're not thinking about it. Your life doesn't end in misery because you're not learning from all of your past. And you find actually your life goes much better. And the monastery goes better. Everything goes better when you just stop thinking about the past or worrying about the future. So just trust in that. Have at least enough faith, because it's only in the present moment your mindfulness can start going strong. And of course, in that present moment, you stop doing all this thinking and stuff like that, because all that thinking is just wasting energy. Wasting energy which should be going into mindfulness. You're supposed to be waking up, getting clear, getting powerful. And so that becomes just the preliminaries of being able to watch the breath. And sometimes, even though I've been meditating for such a long time, I spend a long time in just present moment awareness and silence. I spend a long time there because I know if I go too quickly, I'm just wasting wasting the opportunity, wasting time. If I rush onto the breath too quickly, I can see the breath, I can hold it, but I can't hold it gently. The only way to keep it there is actually to hold it with a bit of force. Because my mindfulness is not strong enough. You can't really see enough of it to interest you. Remember, if you actually see deeply into something, everything interests you. I gave that simile, about walking up the hill, looking at a brick, even doing that walking meditation. When you really got some mindfulness going on, it's anything interests you because you see much deeper into it. So you've got to have that degree of stillness in your mind to have the mindfulness strong enough so when you watch the breath, it's actually an interesting thing to watch. It's not something boring. If it's boring, the only way you can maintain your attention there is through force. Otherwise, you just wander away. And I think each one of you knows just how frustrating it is to watch the breath and it wanders away and then bring it back again. And it wanders away again, bring it back again, wanders away again, bring it back again, wanders away again. It's so frustrating. So what's going on there? Don't keep on trying, wandering, bring it back again. If you keep doing that, you're just going to get bored out of your head. So you're going to get frustrated. You're going to give up. No, why does it wander? So don't just, you know, keep banging your head against the brick wall. Stand back and, you know, use some wisdom. And the wisdom is, you're not ready to watch the breath yet. You've gone there too quickly. The mind is not settled enough for such a refined object. So go back. Go back in more present moment awareness. Just more sort of silence. Just being and just not naming things. And if you develop those things, first of all, and of course I've been doing this for such a long time now, that just you can feel when you've got enough present moment awareness, enough silence, yeah, now I'm ready for the breath. But of course, you can either just invite the breath in, but of course my meditation is on automatic pilot these days, so I don't even do that. I don't invite the breath in. It just, my mind knows exactly what to do. It's done it so many times. It's just like the dog going to the front to pick up the paper and bring it back again. All I need to do is to say, dog, go and bring the paper. And off it goes, and it wags its tail as it does it. And off it goes outside the door to the front door and picks up the paper and brings it back to me and just wags its tail. That's just my mind these days because I've trained it well. So when I just let go, and it just lets go. So it just goes silent. And it's in the present moment, and then the breath comes to me. But maybe that's because I've been meditating a long time. My mind's used to that now. That's what happens. But maybe for you to be able to get that breath to begin with, a lot of present moment awareness, a lot of silence first of all, so your mind is ready. Ready with enough mindfulness so when you start watching the breath, you know exactly what to watch. And it's interesting. And all you need to do is just literally invite the breath in. I say invite because you've got to use language, you've got to use ideas which are soft and gentle. You can't just go and try and hold the breath at any cost. Because if you start doing things like that, it's far too forceful. It's far too aggressive. And look, you should understand the nature of your mind. It's a very refined thing. It's a very subtle thing. You should know that by now. And the only way to have awareness on something subtle, your awareness has to be subtle. You can't sort of like practice like a US Marine. You know, you've got to be like a ballet dancer or just one of these artists who can just... I remember seeing some of these artists painting the walls in the temples in Bangkok. And just, they were hardly moving their brush at all. They were just so delicate, so soft. Or, you know, being the delicacy of like a brain surgeon. Just, you know, one nick in the wrong place and they just send that person into a vegetative state. So they had to be just so careful, but so soft and delicate. That's the sort of mindfulness which we really need. Not harsh at all. And of course, the only way you can have that soft mindfulness without, you know, the breath disappearing, is you have to prepare the mind a lot, first of all. So you're settled down enough, still enough, so when the breath is there, you can stay with a soft type of mindfulness. Too hard mindfulness, and you've not got the subtlety to be able to maintain awareness on this breath. And of course, that old question of where should you watch the breath? Nowhere. The Buddha never said in Anapanasati Sutta or anywhere else you should watch it on your nose, on your belly, or wherever on the body. That's watching the body. This is watching the breath. Not the nose, not the bridge of the nose, not the belly, but watching the breath. And those are those sorts of teachings which are right there in the suttas. But whenever we look at suttas, we add so much. It's really amazing just when you look at life. There is life, and it's quite clear, but we add all of our interpretations, all our perceptions onto it. And even in the suttas as well. There are the teachings of the Buddha, plain and simple, but we add things to it. And this is one example. The Buddha actually said, you look at the Pali, it's just watching the breath. He did not say, watch the tip of the nose. He did not say, watch the belly. He didn't say, watch the body. It's watching the tip, watching the breath, that's all. And if you do that, just watch the breath and don't care where it's located in the body, you are way ahead. Because part of the function of doing breath meditation is so you can get beyond this body. If you watch the breath at the tip of the nose, you have body awareness, physical body awareness. And that physical body awareness is going to open up the channels to itches and aches and pains and all this other stuff which happens with your physical body. To get into deep meditation, you're supposed to be letting this physical sense of touch disappear, so the body vanishes. That's one of the goals, if you like. It's one of the signposts that you're getting still. You can't feel your body anymore. Great, wonderful. Look, I guarantee you'll have a wonderful time when you get rid of this body, if you haven't experienced that already. So the more that you are located on your body, breath at the tip of the nose, or breath here, or breath there, the more that you are stopping the letting go of body. You're hindering yourself, and it's totally unnecessary. It's not what the Buddha said. So you just watch it wherever it happens to be. In fact, when I watch the breath, I've trained myself so many years now, I haven't got a clue where my breath is located. But I did remember once when you just, before the breath disappeared, when it's really smooth and beautiful, just because of, you know, I'd conditioned myself to ask this question. You know, it's almost programming my mindfulness to say, when I get to this particular stage of meditation, I'm going to ask myself, where am I watching the breath? So there I was, just totally unaware of my body, just aware of this beautiful breath going in and out for a long period of time already, and I just interrupted and asked myself, where is that breath located? It was located at the tip of the nose. When I asked myself, I could actually feel it there. And then I just dropped that body awareness to the tip of the nose. It was just interesting, that's all. But I was not aware. I took away that aspect of awareness where it was located and just stayed with the feeling of the breath by itself. Because remember, whenever you have any sensory experience, there's so many aspects of that you could be percipient of. You could be a percipient, you know, say of a cup of tea, of its sweetness, of its heat, of the amount of tea in it, of how much left in the cup, but you can't be percipient of all those things at the same time. So perceptions actually chooses certain aspects of the experience at the expenses of others, which you ignore. So the feeling of the breath, all you're perceiving is the feeling of the breath, not its location in the body. So the location in the body is something which you discard. It's a perception which is available to you, but it's a perception which is going to be a disturbance to you later on. So it's good that you abandon it as soon as possible. So when you're watching the breath, of all the many perceptions available, location is the one which you disregard. Instead, you just feel it. And as you're feeling the flow of the breath. You know it's going in or going out at first. In Anapanasati, it says you know it's long or short, but you can do that if you want to. But just the feeling of the breath. Now remember, you need sufficient mindfulness that you can actually see that, you can feel it, you can know it. With enough clarity that it interests the mind. If you haven't done enough present moment awareness and silence yet, no way you can do that. If you haven't done enough sense restraint during the day, there's no way you can do that. Remember what it says in the Tayanagata Sutta, which we chant on the Patimokkha, Napahaya Muni Kami, Kame, Nekatamupa Pachati, without abandoning, you know, the this five sensory world, or these sensory desires, you cannot attain that one-pointedness. So you need enough sense restraint just to develop enough awareness of the present moment and silence so that you can be aware of the breath. Because otherwise the mind is just aware of coarse things. If it's aware of coarse things for most of the day, you know, it won't be able to watch the refined things such as the breath. However, if you restrain the mind, in other words, you don't let the mind take up too many coarse objects during the day, you know, like lust or anger or just desires for this or desires for that or too much talking. If you can restrain the sort of the senses throughout the day, it's already calmed down. It becomes more sensitive, so it's easier to watch the breath. So I find that if I'm traveling or if I'm doing lots and lots of stuff, just it's much harder for me to watch the breath because my mind has been coarse throughout the day. And so when it gets to watching the breath, it takes a long time, not a long time, but a longer time for me to settle down. So sense restraint is really helpful to be able to watch the breath. just, you know, having a simple schedule, just, you know, being by oneself, not doing too much. And that means the mind does become very, very sensitive. And many of you, when you're on retreat, you experience that sort of sensitizing of the mind so it can see and feel and taste more things than you can normally do. Out there in the world, people are just so busy, their senses are so dull, they need extreme senses, extreme sort of experiences just to even stimulate themselves. Every now and again you sort of start to see what people actually do for fun in this world. Extreme sports, that's the only thing which, you know, wakes them up, you know, to be jumping off a cliff on the end of a bungee rope or something. Or be going to these restaurants where you eat this, was it fish liver, which, you know, kills maybe 100 people. Sort of stuff which, you know, stimulates people these days. Why is that? Because they're so dull. So if you have a sense of restraint, you become far more sensitive, and there's so much going on just in a little forest like this, more than enough to entertain you, to interest the mind. And with that degree of sense of restraint, present moment awareness and silence, it's easy to watch the breath. So remember, don't just think you can do this through force of will. You know, it needs a preparation, the causes. So you put those causes into place. Sense of restraint, simplicity, not talking too much, you know, being in the present moment, silence. And then it's so easy to watch this breath. And of course, it's delightful to watch the breath. It's delightful to watch the breath because it's a simple object, but it's an object which moves. So it's not totally still yet. It goes in and goes out. It has a beginning and end to every in-breath, a beginning and end to every out-breath. So there's enough changing there to keep that mind interested. And of course, the way to keep it interested, again, if you use too much force, it doesn't work. So I've used in Nolamara for so many months now the instruction to be a friend to your breath. You are not the master, you are not the mistress of your breath. So take away that attitude of you are in charge of your breath. Treat your breath as an equal. This is just like a metaphor. It's just a way of using your perception in a way which treats the breath with a sense of a little bit of metta and respect. And you find if you treat anyone with respect, with friendship, they actually like to hang out with you. In the same way, if you treat your breath with a bit of kindness, it actually hangs out with you in the sense that it remains with you and it doesn't go anywhere. You don't need to be afraid your breath is going to disappear. You don't need to sort of use your force of will to keep it there. And using that metaphor of a friend has been very, very helpful to other people when I'm teaching breath meditation. So if you regard your breath as a friend, it means you don't tell your breath what to do. I use that simile, you invite someone for a cup of coffee. You don't tell your friend what type of coffee they're going to drink and just know how many teaspoons of sugar or milk or condensed milk they have to have in their coffee. You just ask them, what type of coffee do you like, friend? How much milk do you want in there? How much cream or honey or what do you want? And you buy it for your friend, because that's what it's like having a friend. So it's the same when you've got your breath. Breath, how are you today? What do you want to do? Do you want to hang out with me? And the breath says, no way. It means they didn't have a very good time with you last time you visited them. So if you're kind to your breath and treat it like a friend, you'll find, just like any friend, they would love to hang out with you and spend time with you. A lot of time, if your breath doesn't stay, if you can't maintain awareness of the breath, check that one out. It means you're not treating your breath with kindness, with respect. That's one of the reasons why it wanders off. And it doesn't matter how many times you go out of the coffee shop and grab your friend by the arm and bring them back in again to sit down and tell them, sit down this time, friend, and stop going out. Of course, as soon as, you know, you lose a tiny bit of attention, they're out the door again. And that's why the mind keeps wandering. So if you treat your breath like a friend and give it a little bit of kindness, the breath stays with you. Now, it also helps as the mind becomes more still. As you spend time with your breath, the longer you stay with the breath, because it is a calming object, and it is an interesting object, I made this observation. I'm saying these things here because a lot of times I just teach this to people at retreats or to people at Nolamara. I don't know if I've taught like this about the breath in so much detail here for years, because I thought you all knew this. But one of the things which I've noticed, with doing breath meditation, it's not just treating it as a friend, but the longer you are still with the breath, again, the stillness. One of the reasons why it's easier to watch the breath is because, even psychologically, all of you spent the first weeks of your life on the tummy of your mother, sucking. And you can imagine just the baby on the stomach of the mother, that is where the rhythm of the breath is first felt. This rise and fall of the abdomen, going up and down at that particular rhythm, is something which the human being remembers as a very calm, secure, protective rhythm. It's not too fast, not too slow, it feels good. The very rhythm of the relaxed breath is something which is very comforting. And I think it's probably because it's one of the first rhythms which you knew in this life. And so it's not that hard just to be with this gentle rhythm of the breath. It's comforting, it feels secure. So it's not that hard to watch. And you keep on watching it for a while, and then you're still enough, peaceful enough, the mindfulness increases enough, it starts to get beautiful and delightful. And of course, this is part of watching the breath. It's a piti sukha coming up with the breath. And that's such an important stage which I keep talking about, because until that delight comes up, that same as the delight in being with a friend, you spend so much time with them, you really delight in their company. Now that is a delight which we should notice. Even to the point when you're doing breath meditation, you should be looking on the lookout for that delight. Because it's such an important part of breath meditation, because that is what really sticks you long time to the breath and takes you even deeper into meditation. The sooner you can generate, or the sooner you can be aware of that delight, the better. Now that delight is often there, but I've noticed that many people just don't notice it. Or if it does come, they think it's something which is evil and going to create attachment. Generate that delight. If you want to know how to generate delight, it's just not having a fault-finding mind in your daily life. There's so much to delight in. Have this easygoing mind, never sort of criticizes people, never finds fault with people. Is this sort of person who always sees that bright side, the beautiful side of things. If you can develop that type of mind, uncritical, not fault-finding, which can be forgiving, it's so easy when you start seeing the breath to see that beauty. Too often that people incline to the faults in life, and they become critical and negative. Such people do have a hard time at this particular stage of breath meditation. They just see what's wrong with their breath meditation rather than what's right with it. It's just a change of perception is needed. And that's one of the reasons why I've tried to encourage the lack of fault-finding. And just to call that word, the fault-finding mind, as an enemy to look out for. So having a mind of gratitude instead, being grateful that for the food we get, which is incredible, being grateful for the huts which we have to live in, being grateful for the robes on our back, being grateful that we can actually live a monastic life in Australia in 2010. And the very fact we can do this is amazing. Being grateful to your friends in a monastic life, being grateful that you've been ordained, being grateful for all the hard work which has been done to create these monasteries so far. That degree of great gratitude is the opposite of a fault-finding mind. And when you develop that grateful mind rather than the fault-finding mind, it's just so easy to see the beauty in the breath. It's just so wonderful just to be able to breathe in beautiful air and just to have the opportunity of not having to do anything, that I'm not asked to do things, I'm not judged, I'm not going to be compared. I'm just in my hut by myself, there's no CCTV cameras. I can just sit here and just be totally free and just watch my breath, and that's all I need to do. And just the pure peace and simplicity of it is delightful. Once you start to see that delight, just the seeing it at the beginning, that's all it really needs. and that delight starts to grow. And if it doesn't grow, and I've told this in retreats, stop watching the breath for 3 seconds and just put your awareness on your face and smile. Fake a smile. And that little trick of faking a smile, it works for me. When you fake the smile, you just push those corners of your lips up, you find it does create a sense of happiness in the mind, psychological joy. And that is just like the match which can light the happiness which was there ready for you to observe with the breath. And once you get that happiness with the breath, of course the breath stays there a long time. And it's necessary to stay with the breath a long time, because when your mindfulness is with that one thing, it means it's simple. It means you're not wasting energy. Remember, this mindfulness is something you've got to build up. And it builds up with stillness. The more moments of stillness you can pile up one after the other, the more powerful your mindfulness is. And to get into deep states of meditation and mindfulness has to be very, very strong. So you have to pile up stillness, pile up simplicity, moment after moment, just watching this beautiful breath and doing nothing else. Every time you go thinking about this or remembering that or planning something else, you are actually wasting energy. That's a simile which I call the leaky bucket. You know, you're pouring water into the bucket, but it's leaking out the end. So you never fill it up. So you've got to sort of block off those leaks, and those leaks are your thoughts, your plans, your memories, and all this doing stuff, all the will. So when you stop all of that and just stay with this beautiful breath and just wait and wait and wait, wait in the moment, so your mindfulness actually increases. It doesn't become boring. It only becomes boring when your mind starts moving and starts to agitate. You just stay with this thing. It's very relaxing, very pacifying, and actually quite fulfilling. You need enough mindfulness to see that beauty, otherwise of course you do just go wandering off. But once you start seeing enough beauty in that breath, it stays. And you don't need to control. It's beautiful, and because it stays, it becomes more beautiful. And that's why I call that the snowball effect. And it's so important to get to that stage, because then you know what meditation is and how easy it is. You get to that stage, and sometimes I have to wait a long time, sometimes a short time before that happens in my meditation, but I can wait because I know it's going to happen sooner or later, because I know how to wait. I don't do things, and I don't rush things. When I meditate, I just sit there and wait. Present moment awareness, silence. Just wait for the breath to come. I just relax, make sure I'm not interfering with the process, no desires. No force, no craving, I wait. Everything starts to become still, my mindfulness increases in power, and then I can see the breath very easy. I carry on like that, just watching the breath, and it just gets more and more clear. It does get to that beautiful stage, and once that beautiful stage goes out, great, I'm off now. The breath becomes more beautiful. This is just what happens, it's almost like a sign that your mindfulness is increasing. I use that beauty in the breath, that joy, as the most important indicator that my mindfulness is increasing. Because sometimes that wisdom can be very deceiving. Sometimes you think you can be watching the breath, or sometimes you assume you're still, but you're not, you're asleep. But the joy is unmistakable. It's a much better indicator to the strength of your mindfulness. So once that mindfulness is strong, there's a sense of joy. The stronger, the more joyful it is. The more powerful it feels. And of course, you can see much more of the breath. And it does become fascinating at that stage. You know, there's every moment of the breath, let alone every in-breath and out-breath is different. Every moment of a breath is different. And as you do see deeply into it. And it is incredibly fascinating. There's so much going on there. Just, you know, before you think it's just breath going in, breath going out, because that's all you see. And once your mindfulness is strong and powerful, you'd see so much in there. And just the same way when you're walking meditation. Before I did walking meditation, I thought just left, right, what the hell is this all about? But when you really get into it, you say, wow, it's amazing, just every movement of my muscles, in my feet, you can see so much which is going on there. And that's where it became just fascinating. I really got involved in that walking meditation and just couldn't believe just how much was happening and just how interesting it all was. It was just a sign your mindfulness was increasing. This is what you have to do with the breath as well, to stay there still long enough, not interfering. Every interference weakens your mindfulness. Every sort of noting, words, whatever, weakens things. So just shut up and just allow the mindfulness to grow naturally. Don't interfere with the process. Once the mindfulness starts getting very strong, you actually see the breath so clearly, and it gets just so interesting. And as it gets interesting, it means you're doing much less. The mindfulness gets stronger, brighter, becomes more enjoyable. And look, and after a while, the joy takes over. Sometimes I call this, you know, the joy which comes off the mental breath. It's that mental aspect of sort of breathing, the joyful part of it. And it takes over, and so really what's happening, you're not watching the physical breath anymore, you're watching the mental breath, the joyful breath. And this is actually where the all perceptions of in and out are vanishing, because you're just going so much into it. As I mentioned earlier, in any experiences, many perceptions are available to you, and the in-out part of it, or beginning, middle, end out of it, those are just coarser perceptions, and you go into just the softness, the beauty, the peace of the breath becomes more important. So those perceptions of beginning and end, or middle, whatever, they are sort of, they fall away. There's just a very beauty of the breath, and because in-out, beginning, end falls away, that's a sign that that physical part of the breath is totally vanishing. Instead, you've just got this beautiful pleasure of just being with the breath. If you do it properly, you've already sort of not interfered. You've already sort of got a deeper sense of silence. You get into this incredible beauty, which takes over. It is what I call the mental breath, for want of a better word. Piti Sukha coming up. And that's just what your object of meditation is. It's a gorgeous, delightful, it is the breath. But sometimes, you know, you think it's just delight and beauty, but it's the delightful and beautiful breath. Now here, you're maintaining awareness on the breath, but it's a different form of breath. There's no perception of in and out anymore. So please don't confuse perception of the breath with always knowing it's going in or always knowing it's going out. That's only one perception available to the breath, but there's more to the breath than that. Even beginning, middle, end, it's only just one possible perception associated with the breath, but it's not the important one. The same where the breath is located in the body is one perception, but it is one of the worst ones to be associated with. So you're actually going deeper into what the breath really is. Not its beginning, not its end, but just breath. Without beginning, without end, just breath. Just right now, in this moment. No middle, no end, just breath. Your perception's getting more refined. The coarser perceptions which are associated with the breath are just left behind. You're getting into this delightful breath. So don't think that you have lost the breath. In all of these cases, that sometimes it comes up, the sort of breath which I'm used to, I'm not aware of now. And you think, I have lost the breath. You haven't lost the breath. You're still watching the breath, but a different perception, a more fundamental perception of the breath, rather than these external ones. It is going deeper into it. Great. So your job throughout the meditation, as I always say, is just please, please, please don't interfere with this natural process. Don't think, I've lost the breath, I've got to go back to the breath again. You are with the breath. The refined breath. Don't just mistake in and out as being the breath. These are just some perceptions associated with the breath. So if you don't know it's going in, you don't know it's going out, great. You're still watching the breath. And after a while of experience, you know that this is the breath. You're just perceiving it in a more refined way. So you know you are actually following Anapanasati right as the Buddha expected you to. You are watching the breath. You just haven't got a clue where it is in your body. You haven't got a clue it's going in or it's going out. You haven't got a clue beginning, middle or end. You just breath, and it's gorgeous. And just with that. And of course, You're going much more to this mental experience now, because it's the joy, the beauty becomes dominant. And of course you don't interfere with anything, it just happens, it's natural, because the joy is an even easier object to watch. You don't have to sort of be friends to the joy, you can't take your eyes off that. To use a coarse simile, just the most beautiful girl in the world walks past, and you young monks, your eyes will follow, you can't stop yourself. And it's the same way, sort of, you know, this beautiful sort of joy comes up in the mind, you can't help yourself but following it. It's just too delightful not to. And this is just what happens. So you just follow this breath and it becomes effortless. And because it's effortless, it means it becomes stronger. When you take away all the effort or the striving, the mindfulness increases. It's not the leaky bucket anymore. And as it gets stronger, it gets more delightful. This is the nature of mindfulness. The more still it is, the stillness is the food for the joy. And the joy makes it easier to be still. That's why I call it snowball effect. And you're just watching this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful breath. And actually you don't really recognize it as a breath anymore. It's just beauty. But afterwards when you reflect back, yeah, that was the breath. The mental breath is just delightful. And of course, from that delight, then you get the nimittas come up. So look, when you get to that stage of delightful breath, sometimes people think they've lost the breath. You haven't lost the breath. Stay there. Don't do anything, for goodness sake. You're just getting used to the more refined breath. Stay in that thing you might call emptiness. Say there's nothing happening there. You can't see the breath. You don't know what's going on. Stay there. Just stay there for a while. And eventually it's beautiful enough to know that beauty, that is my breath. You are watching the breath. Another aspect of the breath. That's how it appears. It's got the attributes. The breath has got the attribute of piti sukha. And that's the one which you really watch. And you watch that piti sukha, of course it gets that strong. When it gets strong enough, it gets so strong that that's where nimittas come from. It's the strengthening of piti sukha. The mind becoming so empowered that it's sort of more strong than the other five senses. So all you see is this beautiful nimitta, and the other five senses drop away. If the nimitta is weak, yeah, maybe you can sort of feel a bit of the body. Maybe you can hear some sounds in the background, like 1,000 miles away, many people say. You can still feel the body, but the nimitta is just so strong. These are called the real nimittas, not these fake ones which come too early, or these ones because you want them. You sort of sometimes psychologically manufacture them. This is the real ones which come as a natural course. It's just, you might call the after image of the breath, the beautiful breath. In the same way, this is a new simile, you can look at sort of a candle or you look at a light and then you close your eyes and you can see the image of that light in your mind. It's like an after image. The same way the after image of this brilliant, beautiful breath is a nimitta. It's just empowered the mind so much, it's given it so much strength and energy that it appears as this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful light. So you've gone past the breath now. At this stage, I don't call this breath anymore. The breath has done its job. And now you've got this credible, powerful mind. Just needs to be calmed down a little bit. Just needs to be stayed with. Just needs to be let go of. You've now got incredible power. And sometimes people interfere when it gets powerful. Yeah, you can let go up to this point, but now you're really going to start, okay, I've got this far now by doing nothing. Now I'm going to take charge. Just like, you know, you're driving the car and somebody else is driving you. When you get to the interesting, okay, you know, get out of the way, I'm going to drive from here on in. This is the fun part. You can't do that. You just spoil it all. So after a while, when you get the message, when it sort of gets into your brain, look, you've gone all this way, you're getting beautiful nimittas just by doing nothing. Just carry on doing nothing. Stop interfering. Stop changing course. Stop changing the method at the last minute. Don't trip up on the threshold. If you do that, just this nimitta just stays and gets brighter and more brilliant. You're having a great time. You just don't do anything. You can take the power. You can take the bliss. just leave it alone, and then you just dive in and get these jhanas and have a great, great time. So the point with the breath, it is a vehicle. As I mentioned to somebody a few days ago, I used a simile from the Samanyapada Sutta, that this Ajatasattu went to go and visit the Buddha at the bamboo grove, and he went into a chariot as far as the chariot could take him. And then he got down from the chariot and walked through the forest as far as he could walk. Remember, when he got through, went walking through the forest, it was so dark, he got a bit scared, wondering whether he was going to be attacked. But he carried on, and when he got to the hall, which was lit, which was bright light, then he could take off his shoes and go into the hall where the Buddha was sitting. Now, this is not what that simile was meant to imply. This is my simile. It's just like you go in a chariot as far as you can. You know, you sort of use the breath as far as you can. And it can get you so far, and get you sort of close, and then you have to let go of that breath. You've got to get down from the chariot. When you're going through the dark forest, sometimes, you know, this is that when you don't recognize what happens when the breath starts to refine, you think you've lost the breath. You use this new vehicle, this pitisukha. Sometimes people get scared when they get to these stages of the meditation. You might get attacked, but just carry on. Until you get close enough to the main hall, you see the beautiful light, the nimittas. And that sort of gives you a little bit of sense of safety. So, you know, the breath can take you as far. The beautiful breath takes you the rest of the way, like walking through the forest. And then you see the beautiful nimitta, the hall. And then you go as far as you can. Take off your shoes, and then you can go to the place where the Buddha sits in the jhanas. That's my little simile. So remember, each one of these meditation objects, if you like, are just vehicles, and you use them as far as you can, but you don't take them too far. Now, I've just described sort of the journey there, but most important, I've described just how these things actually develop. And when people say they do breath meditation, I sort of cringe. You see, you don't do breath meditation. You just let this breath meditation develop. In the same way a gardener never just makes the trees grow. The gardener guards those trees and makes sure that no sort of kangaroo or other person disturbs those trees, to make sure they're well watered and fertilized, and they grow by themselves. And that's a simile which not just myself, but I remember many sort of Kuba Ajahns, I'm going to use that word very rarely in a talk, but you know, at least they'd know meditation. They've used that simile of the planting the tree and the tree growing by itself. Your job is just to guard it. And when you've got this breath, you don't do the breath meditation. Don't make the tree grow. Your job is just to guard it. If there's any effort there at all, it's just the standing and just making sure that no one interferes with this, that you don't sort of make it happen faster or get worried or start interfering and grabbing onto that tree and just pulling it and stretching it and making it grow faster, that you just leave it alone. You maintain this ability to be still and not interfere, to let go, to be kind, to be gentle, to just leave things alone, make peace, be patient, wait in the moment. And if you can just maintain that, this tree grows by itself. You go forcing it, and it just spoils the whole process. You damage the tree. The same way that your job, your effort in breath meditation, not to do breath meditation, but let breath meditation happen by stopping all the interference. It happens quite naturally. And if you don't believe that, if you don't trust that, you can put forth a tiny bit of effort in the beginning, if you like, but in the middle and the end, please, no effort at all. The most important place is the middle and the end. That's where you have to be very, very careful not to interfere. Beginning is a coarser stage of meditation, a coarser state of mind. You don't damage it so much if you do things, but still it's not a good thing to do. But if you really want to, okay, just sit down and tell yourself, I'm going to be in the present moment, and don't put a bit of force in the present moment or silence or whatever, but look, it's best to have hardly any force at all. Be very gentle, because this is a subtle process, this part of meditation. And when you understand what this breath meditation is, you understand just how it works and why it's a great object and why it happens naturally. As I said a few times, I think earlier in this retreat, look, you know, when everything else settles down, when you're not physically moving, when you're not in a noisy place, when you're not doing anything, just what is left to watch? Everything disappears except what's moving. I know that some of you have told me that you sort of start to feel your heart beating, which is, you know, it's not a good thing to do. You don't normally notice your heart. It's much better to notice your lungs, the breath, just the rhythm of the breath moving up and down. Because if you notice the movement of the breath, that's the last thing which is basically left. Nothing else is moving. So if you start noticing that, you're actually doing breath meditation. It's just why I think the Buddha mentioned that this was the best meditation, because it's what happens naturally. You just sit down and do nothing, and everything disappears until the only thing which is moving, the only thing which the mind can notice, is the breath going in and going out. So it's just the slowing down, the stopping. And as that stops, of course, then the whole outside world has stopped for you. When that whole outside world has stopped for you, then you go into these deep states of meditation. And I've mentioned many times why these deep states of meditation are so important. Can't quote the suttas on this, but you know, you all know that simile of the tadpole. A tadpole born in water, grown up in water, cannot know what water is until water disappears. Until it grows up into a frog. Stands on the dry land. No water anymore. Only then can it know what water is. So I say, how can anyone know what the body is until the body has totally disappeared? How can they know what five senses are? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Until those five senses are totally removed. How can they know what will is? This doer, this chooser, this thing which runs your life. How can you know what that is? Until you stand on the dry land of a second jhana and there's no will left. Even a first jhana, there's hardly any will left, so that can be good enough, maybe. But to know what will is. So all the thinking, all the contemplating, all of the inferences is not good enough. Bare experience, strong experience of leaving the body, leaving the five senses, leaving the world behind and being so absolutely still, so silent, so frozen that the world just cannot arise. You've transcended it. And this is why that method of meditation called breath meditation is so powerful. And it doesn't matter whether you've got cold, whether you've got hay fever. Look now, whether I've been staying in UK or here, even in Thailand, there's many flowers there, you get sort of stuffed nose every now and again. And that never stopped me doing breath meditation. Because I don't care whether I'm breathing through my nose or my mouth or through my ear. I don't care, I don't know what's going on, but it's breathing somewhere. Every moment of my life so far I've been breathing, otherwise I'd be dead. So breathing is happening, so it's so easy to watch. And develop enough mindfulness so you can watch. And don't go too fast, otherwise you use force and you can't stay long. Doing it according to the instructions means when the breath comes you can stay with it for just such a long period of time. And you don't have to force it, it just stays with you. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, minute after minute after minute, no effort at all, no problem, easy. Why? Because you're prepared. You've done the foundation. You try and paint the piece of wood, and you haven't sanded it properly, or there's oil on it, there's some sort of mark on it, and it just, you've wasted your time. So please, preparation, sense restraint, bit of joy, recollecting the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or your past good qualities, your good karma, no fault finding, develop that And then this central part of the meditation, central in time, you do something else to begin with, just present moment awareness and silence, developing joy, relaxing, just getting yourself into it. Breath comes up and you just move with that. It becomes peaceful, becomes still, perceptions fall away, joy arises, the joy becomes strong, we realize that is the breath, the beautiful, delightful breath, gets so strong that vanishes and nimittas arise. Nimittas continue as you were going, just don't do anything. Your job is not to grow the tree, just to stand there and just watch it all. Even though it gets powerful, you just leave it alone and you just get into jhanas. It's as easy as that. So that's why the breath is a beautiful path. And hopefully that just reinforce the message which I've said so many times. And hopefully that you know just what to do when you're meditating. You know the sort of the mistakes, you know just how it all works. And especially as Westerners, just we want to know the whole plan of the journey before we embark. You know, if we go sort of on a vacation, we want to know every place we're going to go to and every night where we're going to stay. We want to sort of have it all in front of us before we embark on the journey. That's just our nature. We want to know exactly what's going to happen, even though we're maybe a long way away from those stages. It's good actually to know. It makes one feel comfortable. And so when it happens, you realize that this is a well-worn path, a path of peace, joy, happiness, and most of all, a path of great ease and stillness. And that's how it works. So hopefully I've managed to get most of that into this talk on the meditation on the breath. That's the talk tonight.
Satipano